To encourage himself, he made little goals. Make it to that line of mango trees. Make it to the bend in the road. Make it to that water buffalo.
You had to stand on your own 2 feet and you had to keep moving. If you fell down, you died. If you had to go to the bathroom, you died. If you had a malaria attack, you died. The Japanese would just kill you, period. You had to stay on your feet. If you looked at a Japanese soldier the wrong way, he would beat the hell out of you.
Hello, Anastasia Harmon here. Thanks for joining me for Left Behind the Scenes. These mini episodes allow me to chat with you about a variety of topics in an informal, close to one-on-one format. In these episodes, I'll give you answers to frequently asked questions about the podcast, descriptions about how I research the people I highlight, details on topics that tie into Left Behind episodes, interviews with individuals in the World War II in the Philippines community, and so much more. So let's get started. This episode goes live one day before the 82nd anniversary of the surrender of Bataan Peninsula on April 9, 1942. All the men captured on that and the following days were forced onto the Bataan Death March, which led to an unthinkable number of deaths due to exhaustion, dehydration, hunger, and disease. So to remember that day and honor the men who experienced it, I'm going to share some stories about the Bataan Death March from previous Left Behind episodes. The American and Filipino forces officially stopped fighting and surrendered themselves starting on April 9, 1942. However, some men had been captured in the previous days, and among those men were Captain Jim Gallagher and Private Samuel Stensler and Frank Spears. These three men have become, in some ways, the faces of the Bataan Death March, since a photograph of them as prisoners is one of the most iconic Death March photos. Thing is, though, this picture was taken before the Death March officially began. Actually, one of these men, Captain Jim Gallagher, who was a sports writer from Philly, died the very same day that the iconic photo was taken. A few years after the war, one of his fellow POWs wrote a letter to Jim's father. I'm including it here because it offers a glimpse at what sick POWs faced on the march.
Around 7 a.m. on April 8, we were lined up prepared to march. Captain Gallagher and I were placed in front of the column to set the pace. We marched all day until about 5 p.m. We were placed under a large mango tree and the Japs gave us some hot tea and a small sack of cakes for each two men. Captain Gallagher and I split one bag, which had 34 small cakes. He insisted I take them all as he didn't care to eat. He was pretty much weakened after the day's march without food, most likely not having any food the previous day. While we were sitting there, he went out of his head for a few seconds. I asked him what was the matter and he replied, "I wish I knew." From all appearances, he was full of malaria. At the start of the march, Jim appeared as normal as any of us. We were all somewhat weakened and hungry. He didn't mention anything about feeling badly and seemed okay until the end of the march that evening. After we had rested around an hour, we were placed on trucks and were taken to Balanga, capital of Bataan. We were locked up in the basement of a large dwelling and kept there all night. There were about 100 Filipinos and one more American there when we arrived. During that evening and early the next morning, Captain Gallagher passed out several times. I had some aromatic spirits of ammonia which I held under his nose, which seemed to revive him. We had a few quinine tablets, which he also took. The next morning, April 9, the Japs fed us some rice and canned fish, but Gallagher wouldn't eat. He appeared to be too exhausted. After breakfast, we loaded on trucks and left for Orani. Captain Gallagher had to be lifted on the truck. We detrucked at Orani and were taken in a building, formerly a public market, and were required to fill out some blank forms. During that period, around an hour, Jim was lying on his back and seemed to be asleep. Frank Spear was trying to take care of him. When we were ordered back on the trucks, Gallagher couldn't get up, so Frank Spear picked him up with a fireman's carry and started for the truck. At this time, the Japs ordered Spear to take him across the road and into a small shack. Spear came back just before the trucks pulled out, about 10 minutes. He sat down beside me and told me that Captain Gallagher died in that shack and that he searched him and took his billfold and identification tags. I told Spear he should leave one of the tags on him so he could be identified later, but just then the trucks pulled out and it was too late. Spear later told me he turned in the tags and the billfold to an army chaplain, but I don't know his name. When I last saw him on Spear's back, I noticed his face was real purple and remarked that he needed medical attention, but under the conditions, none was available. In my opinion, Captain Gallagher's death was due to malaria, malnutrition, and exhaustion. He died about 12 noon, April 9, 1942.
If you haven't yet had the chance to listen to the full episode about Gallagher, Stensler, and Spears, I highly recommend it. It's episode number 27, and actually, it's one of the most downloaded Left Behind episodes. In it, you'll learn the fate of the other two men, as well as Private Frank Spears' mysterious origins. Now, while the episode about Jim Gallagher and the iconic Bataan Death March photo is one of the most listened to episodes, one of my absolute favorite Left Behind episodes hasn't been discovered by nearly enough people. This story is about a handsome, mischievous air corpsman named Ray Hunt, who successfully escaped the Bataan Death March, which was an unheard-of feat, then joined and eventually led a guerrilla group. His story is so cool. The Bataan Death March itself officially, and I put officially in quotes because it wasn't an organized event with a starting point per se. POWs joined the march as it made its way northward. But the first men who took part in the march started from the town of Mariveles on the southernmost part of Bataan Peninsula. And Ray Hunt was one of those men. After several days and 50 miles of marching, Hunt was at the end of what he could withstand. And, almost on an in-the-moment whim, he decided to escape. Here's a clip about that action. The sweltering heat beat upon 21-year-old Ray Hunt, blazing at him from the merciless sun above, reflecting up from the dusty, rocky ground, and coming from all sides through the relentless humidity. The heat had followed him for 10 days as he trudged mile after mile up the eastern side of the Bataan Peninsula. Dust and dirt, kicked up by previous marching groups, filled the air, choking him and sticking to his sweat-drenched body. His tongue stuck to the roof of his dry mouth, which hadn't seen water that day. An intense hunger gnawed at his stomach as he attempted to keep pace with the rest of the group, marching in three columns on the road's left side. The classically tall, dark, and handsome young Air Corps man from St. Louis, with eyes that creased in a mischievous glint when his wide smile revealed perfect gleaming teeth, now resembled a walking skeleton. His uniform, what was left of it anyway, hung off his dysentery and beriberi ravaged body. Rage and hatred had grown with every footfall of the 50 miles Hunt had already traversed. Rage at the cruelty and death he'd witnessed over the past 10 days. Anger toward the captors who inflicted brutality that, just a few days before, he could not have even imagined. Looking up from the ground, Hunt noticed a bridge ahead. Below it, a deep ditch. Glancing toward the guard at the group's front, then to the one at back, Hunt moved to the middle marching column. After a second glance, he slipped into the left column. The ditch became ever closer with every step the advancing group took, and then they were upon it. The guard looked away, and Hunt dove headfirst into that deep roadside ditch. Grasses moved under and over him, falling back into place to hide him from the guards. "Don't look!" he heard an American marching above him hiss to another, who had obviously witnessed Hunt's dive. "Do you want to get him shot?" But no shot came. The guards had not seen the leap. The marching columns passed over the bridge, their footsteps fading into the distance and the dust settling once again to the ground. Ray Hunt slowly moved himself forward, crawling along the bottom of the ditch, away from the road before another marching group passed over him. He'd escaped the march, at least for now, but he had to get to safety, to food, and to water, and then he'd get his revenge, or die trying. Hunt had done the impossible, but he was extremely sick. After spending several months recuperating under care of Filipino civilians, he created a small guerrilla group to spread misinformation. Then he joined that group with a larger guerrilla group that was in contact with U.S. Pacific Command in Australia. Hunt went on to lead several raids against Japanese positions, including some that paved the way for the U.S. reinvasion of the Philippines in 1945. Seriously, you've got to listen to this episode. It's number 28, and I've put the link in the show description. I promise you will love it as much as I do. When Ray Hunt and the other marchers from Mariveles had marched about 10 miles along the northbound Bataan Road, they reached Kakaban Airstrip. And they were joined there by several thousand additional POWs who had assembled there on April 9th and had been waiting there for a few days. Among that group, there were two men of the New Mexico 200th Coast Artillery, brothers Jack and Robert Aldrich. Here's a bit about their capture at the Kakaban Airfield on April 9th. Jack Aldrich had reached Kakaban Airfield. He was among the last of the 200th to arrive there. The next morning, April 9th, rumors started spreading. General King was surrendering Bataan. A jeep trailing a white flag and carrying two of General King's surrender emissaries had passed by Jack Aldrich around sunrise as he awoke at the airfield. If you're interested, episode 24 covers the details of General King's surrender. Although the men had seen it coming, surrender was a shock. American servicemen couldn't believe that the Stars and Stripes wouldn't prevail. Battle-hardened men openly cried in humiliation. Some, including Jack Aldrich, still wanted to fight.
"We were prepared to sell ourselves dearly that day. The chaps didn't know how lucky they were when King surrendered. We were sure that even if they did surrender us, it would only be a month at most before the Yanks would be in there."
But surrender had happened, and now Jack and Bobby were prisoners of war. The scene at Kakaban Airfield soon became chaotic as hundreds, even thousands, of American and Filipino servicemen continued to pour out of the jungles. Japanese tanks, trucks, and soldiers soon arrived. The Japanese lined up the American and Filipino prisoners. One POW remembered,
"They had their pistols ready, and I expected to be shot. But they started with stealing jewelry, watches, cigarettes, anything of value."
Another POW shared that a Japanese soldier
"made me open my mouth and looked at my teeth. He held a pair of pliers. I saw him pulling the teeth of several American soldiers. The pliers had blood all over them."
The Japanese soldier was looking for gold fillings, but these POWs were probably too small to be worth anything, and the soldier didn't take the man's teeth, instead kicking him and shoving him aside to continue the gold tooth quest. After looting the POWs, the Japanese herded the American prisoners in a field for the night, with no food or water. The next day, the prisoners from Mariveles arrived. Some 35,000 prisoners of war left the southernmost town on Bataan, about 9 miles west of Kakaban Airfield, on the morning of April 10th. Historians Michael and Elizabeth Norman wrote,
"During the first few days of walking, there were so many men on the road, one bunch followed closely behind another. They appeared a procession without end. Prisoners, as far as the eye could see, mile after mile of tired, filthy, bedraggled men, heads bowed, feet dragging through the ankle-deep dust."
The Aldrich brothers started their march from Kakaban Airfield, thereby missing the first 9 or so miles and ultimately having a slightly shorter march than the men who set out from Mariveles. All along the route, groups of Filipino and American prisoners caught in the jungle and other areas on Bataan joined the march. Jack, Bobby, and their fellow marchers followed the main national road that went north, paralleling the eastern Bataan coast. They marched in groups, 3 to 4 columns per group, 100 to 200 men per column. Guards with 15-inch bayonets attached to their rifles accompanied each group, urging stragglers forward with jabs in their backs. Jack Aldrich recalled,
"We were denied food and water and made to march at a gait that kept the Japs with us at a dog trot. When they were replaced by guards on bicycles, we were pushed faster. And that was when the hot sun and lack of water and food began to take its toll, and guys already weakened by disease and hunger from the Bataan campaign began to fall by the side of the road."
Fallen men were bayoneted and left for dead. One marcher witnessed a fellow prisoner fall to the ground. A guard kicked him and ordered him to stand, but when the young man got only to his knees before collapsing again, the guard kicked him harder, then placed his bayonet to the fallen man's throat, pushed it in, then jerked the blade free. As the guard walked away, the young prisoner lay still, bleeding out in the dirt. Such scenes played out hundreds of times as the march continued. Another POW recalled,
"I remember one boy who was ill and stopped on the march. He was ordered back in line by a guard. The boy tried to explain to the guard by pointing at his stomach. The guard shot him in the stomach."
A few men, however, escaped such treatment.
"I got to the side of the road and fell, holding my stomach. There came a Jap with his bayonet. I moved quick. That bayonet slashed down. I got up and ran, stomach or not. And he came after me hollering. I ran till I got to the middle of that column."
Soldiers and Japanese truck and troop convoys coming the opposite direction would hit the prisoners with rifle butts or bamboo sticks. This treatment of newly captured POWs was basically the norm. Both brothers survived the march and then Camp O'Donnell. But after that, they were separated and taken to Japan, each thinking the other was dead. And this beautiful episode, number 29, is about the blood that binds us and the trials that forge our strength. Lester Tenney was a young Chicago boy who joined the U.S. Armored Tank Division in hopes of serving a one-and-done year in the military. Unfortunately, around the time his 1 year was up, the unit was called into active duty in the Philippines. He, too, was captured on Bataan and later wrote a book about his wartime experiences. In it, he described his time on the Bataan Death March, which I shared in episode number 2. Private Lester Tenney was now a prisoner of war, and despite Japan's initial assurances that POWs would be treated kindly, one of his captors smashed Tenney's nose in with the butt end of a rifle on the very day of surrender. And then he went on the almost 70-mile Bataan Death March through the hot, wild Philippine landscape with barely enough food and water to remain on his feet. To encourage himself, he made little goals. Make it to that line of mango trees. Make it to the bend in the road. Make it to that water buffalo. Here's a voice actor reading Tenney's recollections of the march.
"You had to stand on your own 2 feet and you had to keep moving. If you fell down, you died. If you had to go to the bathroom, you died. If you had a malaria attack, you died. The Japanese would just kill you, period. You had to stay on your feet. If you looked at a Japanese soldier the wrong way, he would beat the hell out of you."
He didn't stop, but he nearly didn't finish the march when a guard on horseback slashed Tenney in the back with a sword. However, he was even lucky in that. At one point, Tenney observed a POW who was sick and disoriented grave for him. When they refused, one was shot in the head. Two more POWs were ordered to dig 2 graves, one for the dead POW and one for the knocked out POW. Tenney later told Parade magazine reporter Peter Moss that he had heard the original prisoner moaning as he was being covered with dirt. Tenney was liberated in a Japan POW camp and then spent much of his retirement years campaigning for ex-POW remembrance and compensation. His is a remarkable story of redemption and forgiveness. Some allies never made it to the Bataan Death March. One such group was a unit of Filipino servicemen from the Philippine Army. Their Japanese captors separated the unit's officers from the enlisted men and then killed all of the officers. This episode, number 31, is a difficult but important story that is all but forgotten in the annals of World War II history. After the war, the leaders who ordered the massacre were tried for war crimes. And here's a snippet of testimony from one of the massacre survivors. Will you state your name, age, and nationality?
Pedro L. Felix, 32 years old, Filipino.
What is your present rank and assignment?
Captain, Inspector General Service, Philippine Army.
Now, in April of 1942, were you a member of the Philippine Army Forces that surrendered to Japanese Imperial Forces on Bataan?
Yes, sir.
About how many men were with you at the time of surrender?
I figure in my particular regiment, we were about 1,500 men, officers and men.
After surrender, you say the men got into trucks and started towards the destination designated by the Japanese.
Yes, sir. We reached as far as the Pantangan River.
What happened when you reached the Pantangan River?
We were stopped by Japanese soldiers who ordered us to get off our vehicles. The Japanese soldiers sorted out the enlisted men from the officers. They then allowed the privates to continue the march towards Balanga.
About how many officers and non-commissioned officers were left when the privates were taken away?
There were anywhere from 350 to 400 officers and non-commissioned officers left.
And what happened?
We were formed into columns of four men, and Japanese soldiers started tying our hands behind us with telephone wire. Each man connected, tied one behind the other.
Go on, continue with what occurred at that time.
We were marched in those columns of four to a ravine and were made to face toward the bottom of the ravine. There was a Japanese interpreter who spoke to us in Tagalog. He gave statements which can be translated this way. My friends, you have to be patient. This is your fate. Had you surrendered earlier, maybe we would not kill you.
And then what happened, Captain?
They made us sit on the ground. Just before executing us, the Jap soldiers around us stuck a cigarette in our mouths and lighted them for us. But on the given signal by the Jap officer in charge, they started bayoneting.
The Bataan Death March ended in the town of San Fernando, which was at the extreme northern end of the Bataan Peninsula. Actually, it's probably not even considered part of the peninsula. In San Fernando, the marchers were packed like sardines into airless metal boxcars and trained even farther north. Men who died in those boxcars remained in standing positions since there was no place to lay them down. Men sick with dysentery defecated where they stood, crammed up next to other POWs in that metal box. At the end of the train ride, the men entered Camp O'Donnell. They were sick, exhausted, starving, and dehydrated. Here's the experience of one seemingly friendless young man from episode 32, which details life at Camp O'Donnell. A 24-year-old American prisoner of war stumbled through the Camp O'Donnell POW camp, searching for water. In desperation, he prayed for help to find something to drink. He'd been in camp only a couple of days, long, torturous days, filled with malaria attacks that shook his body violently with chills, followed by sweating that left him even more dehydrated. He needed water, now. There was a water spigot in camp. He could see it. He could also see the half-mile-long line of POWs waiting to fill their canteens. That one spigot was the water source for more than 14,000 prisoners, and the snaking line often was 2,000 men long. These POWs could wait a good 20 hours for their chance at a drink. The young POW stood in that line for a good 8 hours, enduring the hot Philippine day. Then, the camp's Japanese authorities shut down the water pump that fed the spigot. The young man walked away, more dehydrated and with less energy than before getting into line. He tried to sleep, but the wooden bunks with no bedding dug into his back and hips, making rest impossible. He begged his bunkmates to share their water.
Please, just a sip. What the hell's the matter with you?
Finally, someone offered him a couple sips from the canteen, but eyed him carefully while warning, "Just a swallow or two, fella." The young POW's malaria worsened, and he fainted in the middle of camp, coming to only to find himself lying face down in dirt with other POWs walking right over him. No compassion for yet another fallen soldier. He crawled to the officers' barracks. The men inside had water. He could hear the clank of canteens. And there was a rumor that the officers had 5-gallon cans of water in there. The young POW rested on the ground, his back against a wall under the officer's window. He yelled with the strength he could muster.
"Please, I need water. Can I have a drink?"
No answer came. Could they even hear him? The POW passed out, came to, passed out again. He awoke in the late afternoon and waited for dark before dragging his malaria-ridden and dehydrated body back to his barracks. There, finally, he saw a friendly face.
"You look awful," that face told him.
"I'm sick," the young POW replied. The friend left, returning soon with a few gulps of water and a quinine tablet. The young man took both with gratitude and finally fell asleep. This week, as we go about our daily routines, I hope we can remember and honor the men who endured the unthinkable war crime we now call the Bataan Death March, which, if I'm being honest, is slipping too quickly away from public awareness. And perhaps you can even share this episode with somebody who hasn't heard about it, so that together we can help keep the memories of the men who endured this alive. Well, that's Left Behind the Scenes for today. Be sure to like and subscribe so that you're the first to know when I drop next week's episode. Have a memory-filled week.